Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to all of you for coming this morning. My name is Bruce Weirock, Chairman of Representatives State Affairs Committee. It is January 23rd, 2003, 8 o'clock a.m., and I really appreciate the honor and privilege of serving as State Affairs Chair this year. We are a committee, for the record, that exists under the uniform rules of the House of Representatives, and we have jurisdiction over the programs and activities under Rule 20 of the Office of Governor, the Department of Administration, Military and Veterans Affairs, Corrections and Public Safety, and the programs and activities of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities relating to public facilities. On the committee, serving on the committee is Vice Chair Jim Holm, and also Nancy Dahlstrom, Paul Seaton, Bob Lynn, Ethan Berkowitz, and Max Gruenberg. Present today are Representative Seatons, Representative Dahlstrom, and Representative Holm. And joining us now is Representative Lynn. It's my intention to start these promptly at 8 o'clock. And I'd also like to introduce Ginny Osterman, who is staff to the committee, and also in my office working is Linda Sylvester and Mario Lim. And I hope that the committee members and members of the public remember their names. They're here to serve you as both legislators and the public and members of the administration. So please feel free to come in and use them. The schedule for the State Affairs Committee, the immediate schedule, is that we are going to do an overview with the Department of Corrections today. Next week, we are going to do the confirmation hearings of Commissioner-designate Colonel Craig Campbell for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, followed by the confirmation hearings of Commissioner-designate Mark Antrim, and then followed by the oversight of Military and Veterans Affairs and Homeland Security on February 4th. The Homeland Security portions of that meeting will be an executive session due to the sensitive nature of the issues discussed. The committee has also been referred a large number of bills this year, and it's classically that way every year that the State Affairs Committee has a lot of work to do. And we will work that bill review and hearings on bills into the work that we have to do on oversight and confirmation of the commissioner designates, including public safety and administration, as soon as those appointments are made. I do not want to do any confirmation hearings or oversight hearings of those departments until the governor makes the appointments to those commissioner positions. We do have oversight and program of the programs and activities of the Office of Governor, but we do not confirm the head of that department. So just don't attempt to bring him down here to do oversight of his department or confirm it. I would like at this time for Commissioner-designate Antrim to please take the chair in front of the committee. If you would, sir, the Department of Corrections is not the largest of the departments in the state, but it certainly is one of the most important, and it has one of the most important functions of government. Important function of government is to ensure the health, safety, and general welfare of the public. For the record, joining us now is Representative Berkowitz, and Mr. Berkowitz, or Representative Berkowitz, I'm honored to serve with you on this committee, and I'm very grateful you're here with us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I look forward to being a constructive member of the committee.
Okay. And I had also indicated, I think, for the record, that Representative Hawker is present, and you certainly can join us here. And Representative Samuels is present. You can certainly join us here, too. And thank you for coming this morning. According to Chapter 124 of the Session Laws of 2002, which passed last year, the mission of the Department of Corrections is to protect the public by confining, supervising, and rehabilitating offenders under the custody of that department. And the purpose of this hearing today is to hear an overview of the Department of the Corrections from the commissioner and whoever on his staff that he chooses to designate. And the purpose of doing that is because the legislature has a critical role in setting policy, doing its oversight and establishing the budget for this department, and that's our primary role as legislators. It is not the purpose of this hearing to take testimony on any bills that are in front of the legislature that may affect or relate to the duties and roles of the Department of Corrections. And I would ask that, because there's a great deal of information to go over, would ask members to come to me to schedule further oversight hearings if they desire, or schedule the hearings on bills that they believe are and that are actually in the purview of this department. With respect to questions, I would also ask members to hold questions until the commissioner has concluded his testimony at the end. Members of the public, we are now planning to take public testimony at this point. If there are people on LIO broadcast, are there? No, not today. We will hold those anyway for further proceedings on oversight matters on the Department of Corrections. I'm going to plan to recess this committee at 9:30 or at the conclusion of this presentation and the committee's questions, whichever comes first. And I would ask people to turn their cell phones off unless you need it on for some sort of emergency reason. Are there any questions from members of the committee before I introduce the commissioner and we proceed? Okay, thanks very much. At this time, Commissioner Antrim, I want to turn the floor over to you, and I had asked you to come. I had not defined how you would make your presentation. I wanted to give that to your charge, and you can take the floor now to provide us with an overview of your department and the key members in your staff that will be dealing with the legislature and the policy issues that we'll be facing as legislators. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the committee for giving us this opportunity this morning to present our overview to you. I must apologize at the outset. I have probably the worst cold in my life, so apologies in advance if I'm a little slow on the uptake this morning.
We will rule your cold out of order.
Out of order. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. What I would like to do, as Mr. Chairman stated, is give the members of the committee a general overview of what our department does, starting with our management team, and then just kind of go through the various organization we have, give you a very basic description of what each of those parts does, and then get into some numbers, some population trends, and then just turn it over for general questions, if that would be acceptable to you, Mr. Chairman. It's my pleasure to let you know that our management team is intact, fully selected. In addition to myself as commissioner, we have Don Stallworthy as deputy commissioner. Mr. Stallworthy is not here with us today. He's up in Anchorage taking care of the operations as a whole. We do have our assistant commissioner, Ms. Portia Parker, who's over here.
Now, one thing, Commissioner, if a lot of people here are new and some of the faces are not familiar, so people, they feel embarrassed.
Oh,
they'll have to raise their hand.
Please.
Everybody knows who they are.
Raise your hand, Ms. Parker. Okay, thank you very much. We have our special assistant, Mr. Leitone Tupou, who's right over here. We've got Mr. Jerry Burnett, who is our director of our Division of Administrative Services, and Terry Moss, who's our director of Division of Community Corrections, who handles field probation. Not present also this morning is Mr. Mike Addington, who's our director of institutions. That is our biggest operational division. He is out of the state with a family illness this morning. In terms of organization, I hate to start at the top because my feeling of this organization is really it's bottom oriented up, but it's kind of worked down from the commissioner's office. Commissioner's office, like all commissioner's office, basically is in charge of oversight and policy development and implementation of state statutes and applications thereof. Within the office is the assistant commissioner, Ms. Parker. She's going to serve as our primary legislative liaison during the session, working hand in hand with Mr. Tibbles, the governor's director of legislative. Well, he's legislative director.
Legislative liaison.
Yeah, he's our director of Ms. Parker also supervises our compliance administrator. That's an offshoot of the old clear compliance settlement, and that has gone away now. However, we still maintain what are called best practices in our department to make sure that prisoner living conditions are up to snuff. She also supervises our cultural affairs coordinator, a woman by the name of Karen Nagel, an Alaska Native, who is working in the Anchorage office. Also in the office is Mr. Tupou, as I mentioned. We have an internal auditor, which is new. I think will serve us very well during the session. To one of the governor's missions is to engage in ongoing assessments of programs, and that's something that's very important to this management team. We want to make sure that the state is getting the biggest bang for its buck in all the programs that are offered. So we are very fortunate to have that that position added. I've also listed on the handout the parole board. This is actually an independent board out of the governor's office. However, we do have oversight and budgetary responsibility for the board. So that's a five-member board with support staff. The deputy commissioner's office oversees the training academy. We were very fortunate to pick up another special assistant there, a gentleman by the name of Steve Smith, who is a former lieutenant with the Anchorage Police Department and a recognized national expert in police training. He, until recently, was in charge of the Anchorage Police Department SWAT team, and we're looking to utilize his training to take utilize his expertise to take our training to really the next level in our department, really professionalize things. And a particular concern is to get our probation staff, who are doing spending a lot more time out in the street, giving them basically a better set of safety skills when they're making house calls, that kind of thing. The Deputy Commissioner's Office also supervises the Central Prisoner Transportation Unit. This is a unit based in Anchorage at our Diplomacy Drive building. That unit balances our prisoner counts throughout the state at all of our various facilities and coordinates for transportation to and from all of the various facilities. They've got a small staff that affects those transports and arranges the plane flights and van transfers, that kind of thing. The deputy commissioner also supervises what is called the prisoner classification unit. Prisoner classification is essentially a threat assessment unit that is made up of probation officers that look at each prisoner and assign where in our system is the safest place to house them, and then cuts a move order for the prisoner transportation unit to effect that move. That unit also supervises what is called the Arizona unit, which oversees all of our prisoners that are in our contract facility outside of Phoenix, down in Florence, Arizona. Mr. Burnett's Division of Administrative Services has several subunits, Budget and Finance, which will be preparing quite a few documents for the legislature, Data Processing, Human Resources, Procurement for the whole department on a statewide basis, and facilities management, which oversees all of our ongoing maintenance and operations of our new facilities or our facilities. Mr. Burnett also assumed supervision of the inmate health care, which I'll talk about a little bit later. That unit was until recently underneath institutions. However, because of our concerns about cost containment and the wide ranging of contracting that's done for those services, we felt it was better to put it into Mr. Burnett's area of operation. That brings us to the Division of Institutions on page 2. This is our largest of our two operational divisions, that being Institutions and Field and Community Corrections. Division of Institutions operates a total of 13 facilities that are run directly by the state. We also operate 11 private sector halfway houses that are operated by three different contractors, Cornell Corrections, TMJ Western, and Gastineau Human Services.
Mr. Antrim?
Yes.
Let me interrupt briefly. Mm-hmm. We're joined by Representative Gruenberg, and Mr. Gruenberg, we're honored you could be on this committee with us. We appreciate your seniority, your history, and your knowledge.
My goodness, except for the honor, I'd rather have stayed at home. No, I'm kidding. I'm glad to be on the committee. I asked for it, and I'm glad to serve with all you folks.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad you made it through the wind to get here with us today.
I need a little humor early in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. What I did there was I included some cost figures for you to, alongside the list of our institutions. To kind of give you an idea of what the average cost without our programs, which would include administration, healthcare, and education, that kind of thing, and then what the cost is with those, or what the average daily cost is with those costs built in. some of these facilities are actually, kind of two facilities in one. We have many that serve as a pretrial function. For example, down at Wildwood Correctional Center, that's actually two facilities, Wildwood Pretrial and then Wildwood Correctional Center. However, we try just to combine them just to keep it a little bit clearer for everybody. Institutions also supervises a wide range of inmate programs that are offered to prisoners throughout the state in our facilities. Adult basic education, general education diplomas are available at any and all of our facilities. We operate the Youth Offender Program, which is a rather innovative program down at Spring Creek, utilizing some federal dollars. Substance abuse treatment programs are available in several forms at our facilities, residential education programs. We have two variations of sex offender treatment, a residential program at Highland Mountain Correctional Center, which is a treatment program per se, and then the Lemon Creek Education Program, which is more, which is not recognized as a treatment program, more of an education program. We have a wide range of anger management and batterers programs available to prisoners in our population, and then we do depending on the facility and what we are able to offer, we have vocational and technical training. Lastly, the Division of Institutions supervises what's called the Community Jails Initiative. And this is something that you'll be hearing about quite a bit through the facility. I'm in the process of getting this manual reprinted for everybody in the legislature. We hand this out every year to give you an idea of what is involved with this. And I'm sorry to say that we didn't get this done. Well, we didn't get it to the printer. The Community Jails Initiative is a program that whereby monies are transferred to 15 police departments in the state of Alaska to operate under contract their local jails. We pay these police departments to secure prisoners that are being held on state charges, essentially, is how it works. And I look forward to being able to share this with you because it spells out essentially what the what's involved in the program. What we'll see is that really, this program, by and large, supports a number of dispatchers around the state and really guarantees that we have 24-hour police protection and response at all points in the state. So it's very critical to the operations of localities all over our great state of Alaska. Moving on to Ms. Moss's Division of Community Corrections, this division staffs field probation offices around the state. In most major cities and towns, and that includes a broad range, including towns as small as Kotzebue. And they are charged with supervising offenders post-release that are out on probation and parole, making sure that they comply with any conditions of release. Top of page 3, I included some American Corrections Association guidelines and recommended caseloads. Generally, what they try to shoot for is a caseload of 70 to 75 prisoners per probation officer for those POs that are not writing pre-sentence reports. In the state of Alaska, whenever a felon is up for sentencing, the court generally orders what's called a pre-sentence report that is written to include a lot broader range of information about the offender so that, to assist the judge in determining what sentence is appropriate. That was good. A little Morse code. I was trying to figure out what was. I don't know. Generally, the American Corrections Association says that the average caseload is 70 to 75 with no pre-sentence reports, 60 to 65 with one or two pre-sentence reports per month, and then special caseloads should be around in the 35 to 50 neighborhood. Those standards do not take into account the fact that Alaska is a roadless state, and that has bearing in that our probation officers often have to fly to remote communities to check on their caseload. So it is a little bit different situation than you might find elsewhere in the country. Anyway, going down by the regions, Northern Region, South Central, and Southeast, I've included all the different offices and then what the regular average caseload is per probation officer. We have specialized caseloads for sex offender treatment and mental health in Fairbanks and Anchorage. So those probation officers do have a slightly reduced caseload. But you can see that we're right in the, in several of our offices, we're over the recommended average. But in any case, I just want to let you know kind of what we're looking at. Ms. Moss's division also supervises what's called the victims unit. This unit is charged with working with victims of offenses. It also puts on a variety of what are called victim impact classes to work with offenders and get them to, as part of the concept of just getting them to try and make the victim whole is the intent of that program. That unit also operates what's called the VINE system, the Victim Information Now, every day, which is kind of a unique system in that it's a 1-800 number and you can call up and find out where a prisoner that you're concerned about is located, or if they've been released or if they're still locked up. It's a very nice service for victims. We get quite a few calls a month on that. In terms of overall budget, our FY 2003 budget is $180,762,200.2. This is divided into two BRUs, two budget review units. Years ago, we had each of our components divided into separate budget review units, and that was changed just recently into the two major units, administration and operations, and then community and residential centers being the two. Administration operations are where all of our major divisions are, the commissioner's office, basically everything except the monies attached with community residential centers. That was designed that way to give us a little bit more flexibility to move money around from component to component. Our prisoner population is something I want to spend a little bit of time with you on. As of yesterday, we had 3,123 prisoners incarcerated in facilities in our state, which put us at about 98% of our capacity. We have an additional 622 prisoners at the Florence facility that we operate under contract in Arizona. And we have another 21 prisoners at other out-of-state facilities. These are special case prisoners that are they've got severe what we call separatee status, so they just cannot be housed anybody in our population. It's one of the downsides to having a system as small as ours. We have prisoners who are well known in the system that just get in entanglements over time. We have to just separate them out. We've had to make cell arrangements like this. Those included in that 21 would also be prisoners that are at special medical facilities, for example, or that are still in the federal government system as well. We currently have 170 prisoners on electronic monitoring. Those are primarily located in the Anchorage area. That's a system that we operate in contract with a company by the name of BI that provides us the equipment, and then our probation staff monitors those prisoners. That equipment can take one of two forms. It can be a simple bracelet, or it can also include a breathalyzer machine if that's a concern with the prisoner. As of yesterday, we had 703 prisoners in halfway houses, and 4,778 offenders were supervised by probation field offices. One of your staff members, Mr. Gruber, called and asked about that yesterday, Mr. Chairman. No problem at all. I included some handouts here that much of them contain the same information, just different layouts visually. They all speak to current past population trends, and we try to extrapolate what's going to happen to us in the future, essentially, so we can kind of plan how many beds we need in the next few years. For whatever reason, right now, we are slightly below what we had anticipated. We're about 300 prisoners below where we should be, and frankly, I can't explain that. It's just unseasonably low. I think it has more to do with the weather. There's a lot of, I don't know, just don't know. We expected to have about 300 more prisoners this time this year. But at any rate, probably the most illustrative chart here is this one right here, and this tracks our growth and then puts us, gives you a good graphic example of where we're going to be in about a year and a half to 2 years. So we're looking at about another 1,500 prison beds by 2007, 2006. So really just food for thought. Some discussions develop there. In terms of staffing levels, the Department of Corrections has got 1,484 authorized positions. In our transition documents from the previous administration, it was noted that the FY04 budget is predicated on underfunding to about the tune of $4.4 million in the personnel line. At the time of the transition, we had 143 vacancies. That's risen slightly. And we're working diligently to fill those because many of those vacancies, as I'll talk about near the end, are in the correctional officer and probation officer line, which go right to the heart of our security services. And so we're working diligently to get to fill those. Goals for FY04, we hope to reorganize to pursue some greater efficiency and improve public safety options for our department. As I mentioned, we're going to engage in extensive program audits. We see that as really critical. We want to continue delivering high-quality programs to our prisoners and just make sure we get the you know, effective and worthwhile programs to them. We're going to engage in medical cost containment exercises in a number of areas. We've hired a new Director of Medical Services, and we've got several strategies that we're going to put into play to get a handle on our medical costs. The state's self-insured, and it's one of our biggest budget lines at this point, and it's spiraling out of control, as our health care for many people. We're going to engage in a feasibility study of opening the Anchorage Jail Infirmary. For those of you who don't know, we've got a full size infirmary in the Anchorage Jail, which is a new facility. However, this time it's basically closed because we don't have staffing for it. We've run some cost studies on that, and with a minimal investment, we can realize substantial savings in opening that. We've also engaged in terms of population management. As I mentioned earlier, we're at 98% capacity, and we are low right now from where I anticipated we would be. As soon as we took office, I engaged in some exploring some temporary housing options at the Palmer facility to house medium custody prisoners. That need has not materialized, and of course now we're in the throes of winter, so installing sewer lines and that kind of thing are a little bit difficult at this point, and we're just very fortunate. Just leave it at that. However, we are going to pursue those housing options probably in the spring if the need arises, just so we have more room to house prisoners. One big goal for our administration is to really examine staff recruitment. There have been several articles in the press lately which accurately state that our ratio of Native Alaskans, particularly in our uniform ranks, has dropped in the last 8 years. Also, we've seen a decrease in the number of female correctional officers and probation officers in our ranks, and we see this as an issue, and we're going to address it through a number of strategies, working with our cultural affairs coordinator. Also, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to pursue an improved training academy program with the addition of Lieutenant Smith. I think that'll be a reality, and we'll realize improved officer safety on the street and in our facilities. The governor's directed our department and the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to engage in some exploration of developing improved work training opportunities for our prisoner population. There are a number of Workforce Incentive Act monies that we can get into and utilize, we believe, and we're going to explore that and see what we can come up with. And lastly, we're going to work on improving our missions and measures for the department. Recent discussions with OMB left us with the impression we've got some work to do in that area, so we can give you a clearer assessment of what our missions actually are in each of our components and whether we're meeting those. So I guess in closing, I'd just like to point out that our department has taken on a much larger social services role, I think would be a way to state it, than was probably originally intended. We're widely recognized as the largest mental health provider in the state. You know, we're a member of the criminal justice system, and here we are providing treatment to the mentally ill on a large basis. We have very few sleep-off centers around the state, and so again, whereas statutorily we're supposed to be the sleep-off center of last resort, often in most of our communities we're the first resort. We've got the Title 47 12-hour hold statute, which allows people to be non-criminally committed for 12 hours to sleep off their intoxication so they don't freeze to death in the wintertime, for example, out in the streets. It's a very good statute, but we've assumed a much larger role, I think, than was envisioned in that. Only Anchorage and Juneau routinely charge arrested persons with violations of city ordinances, and what this translates into is that the Department of Corrections assumes much of the cost of incarceration for most of the arrests which take place around the state. And that's something we just need to be aware of. In terms of specific anticipated funding problems, we're looking at an additional $1.2 million stemming from the vehicle accident outside of sewer that resulted in the death of one correctional officer and four prisoners. Several of those prisoners are injured severely, and we are incurring dramatic health care costs associated with them. And we're also anticipating another $897,000 in increased internet technology group chargeback costs. These are costs associated with the use of phones, internet connections, and that kind of thing that are charged through the Department of Administration, each department to that utilizes those services. As I mentioned earlier, the outgoing administration, to no fault of their own, it was a strategy, left 88 correctional officer positions and 16 probation officer positions open, as well as a wide range of classified positions. They basically, our personnel area is one of our largest budget areas. You know, we're a personnel-intensive department. And this was the strategy they chose to save money. The problem is that we're at the point right now where we are impugning our security mission quite dramatically. Several of our facilities, for example, the Anchorage Jail and Cook Inlet facility, are 27 to 29 officers short at any given time, which means that, overall, they're 27. To 29 officers short, which means at any given time we have about 6 to 8 officers on overtime to cover those positions. And the managers of those facilities have engaged in some very good strategies to try and minimize that, but still it's a pretty substantial cost. One of the corollary parts of overtime is that, of course, and this is of concern with our correctional officers and nursing staff, is that we get into for lack of a better term, burnout after a while. The same people keep working, and we see some decreased lapses in security and lapses in medical care. Just leave it at that. And that's one of the downsides to engaging in the heavy use of overtime. So that's about where we are. As I said, it's a general overview, pretty quick. I know that we'll be having hearings, Mr. Chairman, in the future to explore in depth each one of these areas. And,
just in terms of general overview, and just maybe some additional clarification, because there, again, because a lot of these, just briefly touch on these, or maybe your staff, how much of the budget now is from federal funds, and how can that be increased through any actions of the Department or the state legislature? Number two, since medical cost issues was one of the biggest components of your budget, maybe the committee would benefit with a little bit of history of that and what some possible solutions you or your staff have thought about. Number three, the Cleary compliance settlement is something you've discussed, and how is that an ongoing matter with the department and corrections policy? And then number four, because there is a Lemon Creek Correctional Facility here, would it be an opportunity for legislators and or staff to have a trip out there to see that facility and sort of on the ground operations.
And back.
Yeah.
No problem at all. Let me answer that in reverse, Mr. Chairman, if I may. We can certainly arrange a tour for all of you, you know, all of your staff, to go out to Lemon Creek at any time it's convenient for you. Normally, with your committee hearing times, and your workload here is a little problematic, but we've done that.
Don't let us set your schedule. What you should do is define a time, say the bus leaves at such and such a time.
What's worked for us in the past is to have a number of trips available.
Buses you transport, too.
Actually, that's what we've done in the past, and it's worked very well. It's kind of fun for everybody, for our staff as well, believe me. As far as the final settlement question you had, that is done. We have
just briefly touch on Cleary, what it was.
Well, the final settlement agreement was the Cleary lawsuit was filed by a prisoner by the name of Michael Cleary and others. It was an et al. Lawsuit, and a wide number of prisoners filed it, and it related to a broad range of prisoner conditions, things such as access to law libraries, telephones, visiting, laundry, food, temperature, what type of diet would be offered, access to mail, access to attorneys, access to legal calls and legal mail. And they filed a suit because the department, in their estimation, was not providing adequate coverage in these areas. So the suit went on for a number of years, and attorneys with the Department of Law arrived at what was called a partial settlement, and then ultimately the final settlement agreement, which addressed all of these issues. At this time, those issues, basically the Cleary settlement is, and all of the provisions of Cleary are done. And we have established basically, as I mentioned earlier, we still operate a compliance administration office with staff in each facility to make sure that we adhere to those conditions. However, the legal reporting to the court is that component is done. We're out from underneath the court system at this time. So we just believe that to avoid similar entanglements in the future, it just makes sense for us to maintain best practices in many of these areas. So that's about.
And then the other questions were the...
I'll defer to Mr. Burnett for budgetary questions.
Pull up the chair.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. You asked specifically about the federal funds and what portion of our budget federal funds are. I don't have those exact numbers with me, but it's in the 2-3% of our budget range. And in fact, we have more federal authorization in the budget than we have actual federal grants in. So we are actually over authorized. So if you look at the budget documents, we don't have all the federal money. Some of the strategies that have been talked about include additional work with the Department of Labor that the commissioner mentioned for the work job development training for people getting out of the department, and that we do have a federal grants person in the department, and I think the commissioner has instructed them to go aggressively after grants. There's some going home grants and some health care. We're meeting next week with the commissioner of Health and Social Services and the Director of Medical Assistance over there to talk about strategies to utilize some federal money for some of the social programs and health care programs in the department. One thing that happened this past year, which speaks to our medical costs and federal dollars, is that prior to August 12th, 2002, the department was allowed to use to benefit from disproportionate share payments made to hospitals in the state by the Medicaid program. And this past year, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services determined that the state that no state could use disproportionate share funds through a hospital to benefit inmates in correctional facilities as their wards of the state. And the state has full authority and responsibility for those people. The other question you asked was about, and maybe you could restate the question about medical, inmate medical.
What I said was that during the commissioner's testimony, he indicated that medical cost issues was a significant portion of the budget and a growing cost item in the budget. And you were looking at ways, or the department was looking at ways, particularly under your jurisdiction, of ways of trying to alleviate some of those or deal with some of those increasing costs. And what I asked for was some brief, very brief history of that or those medical cost issues, why it's such a problem, and what some potential solutions that are just sort of in the works now to address that.
Okay, well, one of the things that the commissioner mentioned was the looking at feasibility of opening the Anchorage Infirmary. And beyond that, the what's happened with our medical costs, like medical costs elsewhere, the medical inflation is running 12 to 14% per year, which is well above general inflation. But the other, there's some other trends. We are seeing older prisoners, prisoners that are in longer, prisoners that have chronic diseases like hepatitis C, diabetes, require dialysis. And if I could just give you some of the strategies that we're looking at are taking some of these chronic patients who are very expensive. For example, in Anchorage, it costs $21,000 a month for dialysis, which we pay. We have a prisoner who was transferred to the Monroe facility in Washington State. Dialysis there is $56,000 a year. So we have to look at, with chronic hepatitis C, diabetes, dialysis patients, cardiac patients. We have a very good contract in Arizona with a medical group with the cardiac unit, which is well under the cost in Alaska. So we're looking at where we put our prisoners, whether, you know, we have direct care. Some of the other issues here, though, are recruiting medical staff. It is very difficult for the department to recruit nurses, just like every other department in state government. And when we don't have the nursing coverage, we have to get a contract nurse, which costs the department a great deal more money, or we have overtime. Or if there's not a nurse in the facility, the only alternative sometimes is to call an ambulance and send the person to the hospital for $1,000 a day. You know, $1,000 for the ambulance call and $1,000 a day for the person to be at the hospital. So, you know, we are looking at where we put our prisoners, our medical contracts. We just renegotiated a contract with Alaska Regional this past week and got an additional discount, which will save us tens of thousands of dollars this fiscal year.
One of the things you mentioned is all these authorizations for money, but that you haven't fully tapped into the potential there. And a lot of that work sounds like it relies on the work of a single grant writer. Is that?
Well, I think in years past we had fully utilized those federal grants. Is my impression. Right now we seem to be the low point, and we're going to pursue very aggressively federal grant monies.
Is there any policy change the legislature needs to look at in order to increase the efficiency of your grant writing ability and getting that federal money?
I don't believe so, no. No, Mr. Chairman.
One final question I'll ask, and then Representative Holm, what's the focus on drug, alcohol, mental health treatment, and that sort of thing for inmates? Isn't it true that a significant portion of the population wouldn't be there if it wouldn't be for mental health, drug, and alcohol reasons?
Well, that's true, Mr. Chairman. A large percentage of our prisoner population is directly related to those substance abuse issues, and we provide a wide variety of services to those folks. The problem is as treatment providers will tell you, or the trick, I guess, is getting these folks to realize that they need treatment, and that they do, in fact, have problems. That's really the big hump that we have to get over. And that's one area that's a very big concern to us. We're throwing a lot of treatment dollars at people that really don't want to be treated. And so it's one of the areas we're looking at kind of changing our focus a little bit and focusing more on possibly educating them, getting them to realize they have issues in these areas, and then following that up with the treatment programs we have in place. I think that's one component we've been missing, though. The reason, that bears out by what we see in the field in terms of repeated offenders coming back that have gone through all of our alcohol treatment programs time and time again, and they keep coming back for the same types of offense categories. And this is certainly foremost on our when we talk about auditing programs, for example. That's one area that we're going to look at to make sure that we're really approaching it in the way that is most effective to get that job done.
Thank you. Mr. Burnett, I was curious a little bit to follow up on this, the moving of prisoners around the country because of their particular medical problems. Do we have some sort of asset recovery from the prisoners, assets in place where if in fact they do have, or if they have some other type of medical insurance, or they have homes, or they have something that we
have
in a lot of state?
We do have, sir, if I may, Mr. Chairman, we do have an enabling Alaska statute which allows us to pursue third-party billing, for example. This is one strategy that Mr. Burnett's going to follow up on. We have not made use of that historically in our department, even though the statute is clearly there. Many of our prisoners, for example, shorter-term prisoners, do have Blue Cross and Blue Shield. We just don't pursue billing it.
I would suggest that we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through the chair, we have, in fact, started collecting within the last 2 weeks. We started collecting that information on intake.
Right.
It was
right.
Not collected previous.
Right. That. We made it a question on our booking sheet to see if you have a third-party provider, and then if they get into trouble while they're there, then we start billing them. And it's just something that apparently fell through the cracks.
In that vein, the chronic inebriate problem that we have, I happen to sit on the board of the Fairbanks Hospital Foundation, and we end up spending an inordinate amount of money in our emergency room with the chronic inebriate problem. How does that tie in with the number of people that you have incarcerated? How do the chronic inebriates fit into your caseload?
Mr. Chairman, what happens is that if many communities, Fairbanks being one of them, do have what are called community patrols. Juneau has the same service, and that's the party that brings those folks to the Fairbanks Memorial. What happens is if those people are all combative, which many of them are, then they come right to the correctional center, and that's how we get involved. So that's basically how it happens. So.
I think lastly, what kind of policies are you going to change? Do you think about it? Are they going to change to affect the Cleary settlement? And by that, what I'm alluding to here is because of that Cleary settlement, we've got inordinate costs in the state of Alaska for prisoners, and or greater than it was beforehand. Do we look at economizing somewhere? 1,400 or whatever number of employees and 4,000 people incarcerated, that's 4-1, it seems to me. I don't know if that's traditionally, if you went throughout the United States, is that a good number in relationship, or is there some way the legislature can help facilitate a better?
The number is probably very close because, you know, what we have to remember is that, you know, these are shift workers, so whereas it may appear to be a 4-1 ratio.
Three times that.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of policies to change Cleary, I think it's one of our goals is to do an assessment on that. We've gotten some information from Department of Law quite recently that has indicated to us that we've got some flexibility in some areas, and we're going to fully explain and expound that.
Representative Berkowitz? I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
Commissioner, I'm sorry we haven't had a chance to meet before today. I'm sure we'll see more of one another as time goes on. I had a couple of questions about a number of areas, Mr. Chair. You indicated you wanted to improve public safety, and that's a great concern of mine, as well as officer safety. I know that in Alaska we have one of the best rates of correctional officer safety anywhere in the country. I think the incident rate is about 1 per 1,000 inmates, whereas nationally it's almost 30. And I'm just wondering, what specific proposals do you have to improve public safety and officer safety?
Sure. In terms of staffing right now, we're at critical levels. That's basically with these open positions. Our facilities are designed in a way that is less than optimal to staff. Many of them are linear in design, and so you have to have people stationed throughout the a given hallway, for example, to supervise housing units that are off each side. If we're short, people are in those hallways. The prisoner population is at risk, as are the other staff in the building. We're just operating at reduced levels. So that would be our priority, is to refocus our budgetary direction to make sure that as many of those positions are filled as we can. Likewise, I would like to see an increase in the number of field probation officers, because we are supervising a wide number of people in the field right now. If we fill the vacancies that are current, that's 16 right now, with the caseload numbers I gave you, that will have a dramatic effect in reducing those cases. I think that about says it. I just want to make sure that we have the highest number of probation officers out supervising a lower number of caseloads in the street. This is what would be my main goal.
And so, there's Senator Dyson and I have a pet project together, which is restorative justice, and some of the other kind of programs, like the JAZZ program up in Anchorage, which is a mental health pilot program that's been very successful. And I was just wondering what the department's commitment to those programs is going to be.
Well, restorative justice is a longstanding approach that our department's had the last 3 or 4 years. We've been very active in restorative justice. I'm very familiar with it. The JAZZ program we were just discussing earlier this morning, actually, which is, again, a special population caseload for our probation officers to deal with mental health folks. I believe our commitment in both cases will be static. They're very effective.
And two final areas, Mr. Chair. One, I'm sure, is going to be a great interest to you. Candidate Murkowski indicated an opposition to private prisons, and I was wondering whether the department's position is going to be maintained.
Well, the governor was very clear in the campaign. That's his position now. It's our position as a department. We are open to working with all legislators to explore any options, getting to the solution on beds.
Final question, it's mostly for the chairman's benefit, is what are you going to do with employee contracts? I know that's always a Juneau concern.
Well, I can tell you through the chair that we are in active discussion right now with that. Again, for our department, for the personnel component is so large, we are very in tune with the direction that the negotiations are taking, because it does mean quite a bit to us in terms of budget.
Mr. Antrim, which unions work for the Department of Corrections?
Well, quite a few of them, actually. We have Local 71 covers our maintenance workers and our kitchen stewards. APEA covers our probation officer staff. PSEA covers our correctional officer employees. And then we have SU, the supervisory unit that covers our assistant superintendents, supervising probation officers, and superintendents.
Who on your staff is sort of liaison for those?
Well, we have not formed a liaison with administration yet that has taken the lead on those negotiations. They're actually putting together working groups, as I understand it, in administration right now. And I would imagine myself and Ms. Parker and Mr. Burnett will be all involved in that.
One of the, I've got young kids, and they're very impressionable in it. And it's a very stressful and fearful environment in prisons and correction facilities, and I appreciate the heavy burden that your employees have to face every day in their jobs. But it's also something to impress upon the youth of this state that you don't want to be in here. And what is it that corrections can do to educate or advise or talk with kids about the necessity of, you know, staying away from things that are going to get you in?
You know, right now we have a, Mr. Chairman, right now we have a very active close-up program. We participate at several of our facilities in that program. That's a, brings what it does for those of you that are not aware. Many kids come in from Bush schools and they tour, for example, in Juneau and a number of government facilities, one of which is the jail out at Lennon Creek, and we do a similar program in Anchorage as well. You're right on track. I would like to see that expanded a bit. The impression, well, the way the program works here locally is they come in, we've identified a number of long-term prisoners for them to kind of tell about their stories in a very secure setting, obviously, for the kids with the teachers. The impressions they come away with are mixed, usually very impressed on in terms of, one, the facility, and two, the hopelessness of the people that they've heard talk. And I think your point is well taken. I think it would be a good thing for us to see if we can't, you know, offer more access to school children on.
It doesn't take much to leave a significant impression.
No, it does not, particularly in that setting with the razor wire and the lights, and it's very, very imposing. And the impression that almost uniformly all the kids come away from is that that's not anywhere they want to spend any time. So
it's that day.
Yeah, at least that day.
This chart that you showed and discussed and that you passed out to the committee shows the inmate population statistics, and it has just sort of a straight line projection. Is this based on any data in terms of, is an inmate population based on a percentage of the population in general? Is there any correlation between total population and inmate population? I mean, you can continue this in a way.
Oh, it can go.
You and I are going to be in jail.
Right. Well, I think it's based on an increase, hopefully an increased population in the state of Alaska. I hate to see either one of us in jail, but it's based primarily, I believe, on the baby boomer increase in the population of the, you know, our prime age group for criminality is, you know, 18 to 26 roughly, and so when that, as that group increases, you know, as there's an ebb and flow in that population, so grows our prison population. We are anticipating growth in the foreseeable future. I mean, that's just that is just in terms of a correlation, not tied to increased population in the state as a whole or anything else.
There's an earthquake.
There's a vastly disproportionate number of Alaskan Natives who are incarcerated. I'm wondering what the department is going to do in terms of cultural programs or other initiatives in order to restore some balance.
Well, I think that may be, through the chair, that may be almost two separate questions. At any given time, roughly 34% of our population is Alaskan Native. That is correct. The fact is we are actively engaged in providing a number of culturally relevant programs, and we hope to increase those. That's something I'm very in tune with. When I mentioned earlier about attracting more Native employees, really my focus there is that is to prisoners engage in modeling. It may sound kind of corny, but you know, correctional officers are really one of the few stable people that they have in their lives. I mean, they always are there. They always come to work every morning. They always have a tie on, or if it's a no-tie facility, they're always dressed and pressed. And the impression I came away with is, although they probably disagree with just about everything that person stands for, at least they know that they're steady and they're there. When I say corny, I guess maybe that's a poor choice of words, but I would like to see some Native Alaskans modeling in that same way for that population, because what it will do is show them that there's some value in showing up to work and being responsible. And I, but as far as culturally aware programs, we have potlatches at numerous facilities. Native art opportunities are abound. We have, in associated with the potlatches, there are native foods that are brought in. So we try to incorporate as much of that as we can, and that's why we've all, for the time that I can remember, we've had a cultural affairs coordinator position as part of the management staff. So
if I could, Mr. Chair, would there be an effort to expand regional facilities and community jails?
That is something we're considering in this part of our capital request, yes.
Representative Seaton and then Representative Lynn.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Commissioner, I just wanted to say that I had had a chance to tour the Spring Creek facility a month or so ago, and I'd sure like to compliment the division on the facility. It was well run. The activities that were there, the learning that was taking place, not only in the wood shop, building some of the chairs that were sitting on here, the exercise facilities that were all prisoner purchased through the, I was happy to see that the prisoners were actually funding their own library, their own weight facilities. All those things were all taken care of that way. And so I was very impressed with the facility. I am a little concerned here on page 2 of the report. I mean, my impression has always been the maximum security prison, and I believe Spring Creek's our only maximum security prison, is coming in at one of the lowest per person per day rates of the facilities that we're seeing here. And I'm just wondering what whether that's a function of the facility or whether that's something we need to spread to some other facilities or what, because I like I say, I think it was a very well-run facility.
Well, generally, through the chair, it's generally tied to economy and scale. With a larger facility, you're able to cut food costs and purchase larger volumes, so that drops a number of fixed costs for us. Also, the staffing pattern at Spring Creek lends itself to using fewer staff just because of the way the facility is laid out, with the central control rooms and the ability to observe large numbers of prisoners using one person. I don't know if you got into the control room or not, but as you saw, one staff member can observe a large population of prisoners, and as opposed to how some of our other facilities are staffed, which require, as I mentioned earlier, kind of linear hallways with staff stationed throughout to look off to the side. It's just a much more efficient plan. So.
Well, in additional or planned facilities, then, would we go more? I mean, if it's more efficient to have a maximum security prison setting and it costs us less, then in medium and low risk facilities, would we tend to go to this model, as we can actually service prisoners to the state cheaper under that form?
Through the chair again, yes. Actually, the one of the newer housing units out in Palmer follows that model. If you get a chance to tour out there, you'll see a very similar kind of thing. There's a raised platform, and the officer in that area then is able to see up and down both housing hallways. And that is a medium or minimum housing unit. And, but to answer your question, yes, we'd pursue Spring Creek is the last maximum security prison that has been built in the state. We would certainly follow a model that would use fewer staff, which is, you know, that's how we realize economy.
Mr. Seat, fine, and then Representative Lynn Dalton from Greenberg.
Through the chair, I was wondering, the youth offender caseload, is that included on page 3 under the correctional officers? The youth offender probation officers and all, are those included in those numbers, those caseloads, or is this just adults?
This is just adults. Any youth offenders are covered by the Division of Family and Youth Services, the Division of Juvenile Justice. So it's a whole different set of employees and caseload standards also. So.
Okay, so is that under your department?
No, it's not.
That's not.
No, it's not.
Anything else?
No, I think that's all.
Okay, yeah. Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank you for being here today. This is a good learning experience for me, and I believe for all of us. I did have a couple of little questions here. Many of my constituents would like to know what level of amenities that the prisoners enjoy at the at the various security level prisons. I'm talking about things like television, internet. Exercise facilities. You know, some of us are concerned that a dangerous prisoner is in better physical condition than I am. How are these things funded, and how much of this is going on at the different places?
Well, through the chair, there are a varying number or amount of amenities depending on what facility the prisoners are located at. But as a general rule, we have a statute in place now for several years, known as the No Frills Bill. What that bill did was limit the amount of things like free weight equipment, the types of entertainment the prisoners can have in terms of CDs and cassettes, and then what CDs, for example, can have, they can have warning labels on there. It can only be PG content, okay, if you will. In terms of television, the facilities, generally speaking, are set up so that there is a television with limited numbers of TV available, or limited numbers of channels available, in what's called a day room kind of a setting, or a common area. Normally it's basic cable level kind of television, very, very limited number of channels. Some of our facilities do offer prisoners the ability to purchase cable TV and televisions on their own to have in their own rooms. Now, whereas that might sound on its face to be of some concern to you and your constituents, the way that that is used is as a management tool. Prisoners are less likely to get out of line and, for example, riot or cause disturbances if they have these high quality items in their homes, in their residences or their rooms. Bearing in mind that the prisoner economy is drastically different than ours, a television represents the same amount of money that buying a car might to you or I. You know, they're making 40 and 50, 60 cents an hour. And so a $100 television is a large acquisition. So they are extremely reluctant to involve themselves in any kind of disturbances that could result in the loss of that. So it really is a control agent more than anything else. In terms of other amenities, each of our facilities operates what's called a commissary. What is offered in those individual commissaries varies from facility to facility. There are general things like potato chips and certain types of candy that fall within our guidelines. Hygiene items, that kind of thing, are generally offered. giving you a sense of what you're asking. I think you'll find that, and I guess I would encourage you to take this tour, because what you'll see is that the dormitories at the facility that's operated here locally are very, very Spartan. And at this facility, that's how that works. There's the open dormitories that have a very low level of property, and then the individual double bunk cells that have a higher level of property. But even those are fairly Spartan, because prisoners have to pay for all that themselves. They've got to work, and then they can buy these things.
I should note, because the record will be recorded for posterity, that Representative Lynn, you cut a fine figure of a man, and
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm glad that's going to be recorded.
As far as exercise equipment, that is a very key part of the no-frills bill. They're not allowed to have free weights and that kind of thing. And as you'll see on your tour, we have what are just isometric body weight kind of exercises, bars that utilize weight to, the prisoner's own body weight to build themselves up. Your comment about prisoners being stronger than you and the general public is well noted by the staff as well. So that's something of concern to us, and that's why that was the basis for that bill being passed.
I'm also concerned that many of these prisoners, I would assume, have more amenities than poor folks in the general population who are not criminals. And many of us can't afford cable and fancy exercise equipment and so on. But if I would be incarcerated and become a model prisoner, then I can have these things. I can become a model citizen but not have any money and not have these things, and that's a concern to me.
Well, what you'll find is that even at this facility out here, the reality is that very few prisoners actually have their own TVs in their rooms. They just can't afford it. As far as fancy exercise equipment, it's not going to be anything like you'll see at the Juno Racquet Club by any means. We have the superintendent has put into place some what are called maximum security bicycles that were taken from a design at Marion, Illinois, the federal facility there, and they are not a nice exercise bike. I'll put it that way. They're very, very Spartan and very utilitarian in design. They do have a nice gymnasium. And a nice outside recreation yard, that is true.
I'm a bit of a handicap here because I seldom see the inside of a gym, so I don't know. One final question. What are the significant differences, if any, between the prisoners housed within the state of Alaska and those housed outside, like in Arizona?
Well, our contract calls for them to have similar amenities and similar housing kinds of situations. So, in theory, both are very similar in terms of what are offered. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, that's what we're striving for, what are called, good correctional practices, and that falls completely within that range. Some of our facilities offer more amenities, some offer less, and that's true of most systems, depending on what the mission of the individual facility is. Booking facilities, for example, that are like the new Anchorage jail, prisoners are there a very short time. They have basically nothing. Longer-term sentence facilities, like the one that Representative Seaton toured down in Spring Creek, they'll have more amenities. So,
I want to thank you very much for responding here. I do have some interest in this. I'm a former policeman in the city of Tucson a long time ago, and I have worked as a jailer in the city of Tucson in the old jail we had there, and I'm the son of a Los Angeles County Deputy Sheriff. But I want to thank you very much for coming before us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
You're not the reason they call it Tombstone.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and a question. I would like to share with you that as a high school student, I had the opportunity to go on a tour of the Utah State Prison and get on the bus and drive into the point of the mountain. And I am 45 years old, and those impressions have never left me. It was an extremely significant day in my life, and I will never forget walking down the halls and the doors shutting behind me, all the doors over and over and over, and knowing I was within the bowels of the system and people hanging out through the bars trying to grab at me. So I do appreciate the comments that were shared earlier about the impressions for children. I think it's extremely important. I have a question about the internet and phone use for prisoners. I have background working in telecommunications industry, and I'm aware that in the past there has been some abuse of the phone systems, and I wondered if you could share with us the checks and balances that are in place for those and what type of internet access they have, if any.
Certainly, through the chair. As part of the No Frills bill, internet access was totally prohibited. The reality is that internet access is available for prisoners to get information from through an education associate. So it's always a monitored enterprise, and it's very, very limited in that application. So effectively, prisoners do not have access to the internet. Okay, and that is something that we're going to hold the line on, as much as there would be some positive opportunities to be gained through that. The risk to the general public, you know, would just overshadow any possible gain, in my mind anyway, at this time. As far as telephone, we have had quite a history with that. Until quite recently, prisoners had basically free use of the phone and could call anyone they wanted to, anytime they wanted to. I have, as a shift supervisor and as a supervisor in the facilities, I can't tell you how many calls I got from parents, you know, saying, why can't you, you know, can you make this person quit calling my daughter? And there's really nothing you can do other than throwing the person into what we call an administrative segregation cell and basically controlling their access to all phones. Recently, in the last 2 to 3 years, the department entered into a contract with the Evercom phone company, which is a nationwide prison phone provider, after clearance from the Alaska Public Utilities Commission regarding the rate structure, which was a little bit problematic, but it worked itself out. All of our facilities, with the exception of one now, have this phone system in operation, and it's a very interesting situation. The company provides the state with monitoring equipment and basically phone control computers and software, so that we can limit exactly who prisoners call and that kind of thing. If I get a complaint today, or one of the staff at one of our facilities gets a call, they can put a block on the number right now, and no prisoner can ever call that number again. It also gives us monitoring capabilities, which is critical in that we, on some cases, we'll get complaints from people involved in domestic situations. For example, let's say my husband is calling and harassing me. Well, sometimes that's true and sometimes it isn't, you know, and so that's been very, very good for us. But to answer your question in a broad way, we do have total control over our phone systems now, and it's a very well received system at the facilities, and which is not to say that some negative phone calls don't get through to the general public, but when they do, we can finally put a stop to them now. So it's you will hear some complaints, however, from constituents around the state, I can tell you, because of the rate structure of the system. Those of you with constituents in bush communities, where telephone communication is absolutely critical with their prisoners that are, you know, incarcerated facilities, they're concerned because the phone bills are high. Essentially, the way it works is kind of a cost plus. They pay the regular phone bill plus another fee on top of it to use this phone system. So it can be expensive. At my mind, at this point, though, I think in terms of public safety again, I think it really is beneficial to keep the system in place. The positives far outweigh the negatives at this point. You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you mentioned, I thought, that you expected a $4.4 million shortfall. Was that the right figure I heard?
If you want, I can speak to that.
Please.
through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, the personal services shortfall was $4.4 million based on the budget and the past administration, and currently we're keeping vacancies to a level to offset that 4.4 shortfall.
What's your total expected shortfall?
That's a really good question, and I would be happy to answer it, but
my best shot.
Finance officer is actually working on projections right now. I think there's an expected shortfall that the commissioner alluded to, about $1.2 million because of an accident on the Seward Highway in the fall.
My question was whether that was within the 4.4. Obviously.
Okay, our shortfall will be much less than the 4.4 at the end of this year. If you're
right.
Looking for what we might request for a supplemental.
That was only part of my question.
Okay.
My question was, what are you going to be looking at for the next FY?
That's something that we can't answer at this time because we've been working with OMB on that question and do not have a budget agreement.
Okay. That was my first question. My second is, I know you're having trouble getting contractors for the ignition interlock program. How are you coming?
Well, effectively, if I may, through the chair, there are no contractors this time for the ignition.
Even in Juneau?
As far as I know, no.
Why is that?
Well, the statute enables these operators to come into the state. I've actually spoken to a number of parties about this quite recently. You know, the problem for us is how to encourage these vendors to come in.
Right.
And then putting the mix into the court system has to order that as part of a...
But they have to be here first.
That's true.
So how are we going to get them here?
Well, I guess we'll just have to...
I don't need an answer now. I would like to work with you folks on that. That was my bill, and I know it's a good bill.
It's a good bill.
I don't need an answer now. I'm trying to be helpful here. I'd like to support your efforts in any way I can. I would like your staff to work with Justin Roberts on my staff on that, and I just would like to extend that offer.
Through the chair, may I ask the representative a question?
Yeah, and I also think in your answer, you should just give a brief introduction of that program that this colloquy is about.
Well, Representative Gruber's bill authorized a program that could be utilized by the court system where, as part of a sentence, they could order a vehicle ignition interlock with a breathalyzer as part of the probation for a repeat DWI offender, essentially.
Any
alcohol offense. The problem is, I guess my question was when you were putting that bill together, did you have vendors that were interested?
Absolutely. Well, there was Guardian Interlock and several, and I know that there are a number nationwide, and I just kind of wanted to open the door so that we could work together to try to find...
Well, I wonder why they haven't come forward to enter the state market. I mean, I wonder what their impediment is.
I do, too.
One thing we can do is, in the context of a specific proposal or bill, we can go into that particularly in more detail. Yeah.
I was not thinking of any legislation at all. This was more of an administrative thing, and it's a good program. It saved lots of lives.
Well, the statute is very good in that it provides for a lot of... making sure that the equipment is at a certain standard, and it seemed to be, I really didn't have an answer at all for the party that called, other than to say, well, I guess, you know, the private sector has to step forward, and now that the statute's there, and just present the equipment.
We'll talk, but if you could just designate a member of your staff to work with Mr. Roberts, then we'll start moving on.
Certainly. Sounds good.
Let me recognize Representative Berkowitz at this time, but let me first ask, does the Division of Youth Services Juvenile Incarceration fall within your purview?
No, Mr. Chairman, it does not.
Which?
That's Health and Social Services.
Okay. Right. Representative Berkowitz.
Very quickly, first is a formal request. I guess most of the
committee might appreciate it. I understand you guys are doing an audit and love to have the results of that audit when you're done with it. Secondly, it's widely known around the building, perhaps even greater circles, that you've been asked to come up with 95 and 90% scenarios, or 5% and 10% cut scenarios. And I'd also appreciate any sharing of that information once you arrive at those conclusions.
Thank you. Yeah, try and get that. Representative Hawker, could you join us up here, pulpit chair? And you had a question, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I'd like to commend the commissioner and the department on the hiring of Steve Smith to head your training facility, training academy. Being personally and professionally acquainted with Mr. Smith, I truly believe you've hired one of the most qualified people in the state of Alaska for that position. But question-wise, perhaps you could clarify for me the interrelationship of the funding of medical benefits or medical costs for Alaska Natives, the interrelationship between IHS, PHS coverage, and what the state of Alaska bears.
I can speak to that, because I did talk...
Mr. Burnett, excuse me. I hate to sound like an idiot, but can you define the terms, too? Just the acronyms.
I believe you ask about, through the chair, Representative Hawker, you ask about the Public Health Service and the Indian Health Service benefits for Alaska Natives, specifically.
Yes, sir. It's PHS, Public Health Service, IHS.
Right. Okay. At this point, when the Department of Corrections has someone in their custody, there is no payment from the Indian Health Service, Public Health Service, Medicaid, Medicare to the state of Alaska for the benefit of those people. It's all borne by the general fund.
Thank you. Take care. Sure. All right. You're welcome to stay up here. By golly, we're glad to have you and Mr. Samuels.
I very much appreciate
that. It's a big table.
Yeah.
Any further questions from the committee?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes. Representative Bloomberg.
Two things. First, that might be a really good source of some funding and maybe a resolution or something from the legislature urging that that be done. I think that would be a great idea. My other questions related to the interplay between two documents, one being the missions and measures legislation, Chapter 124 of session of this last session, Chapter 124, SLA 2002, and the transition policy transition team report. The legislative statutory changes recommended in the transition team report, the first two relate to medical care, since we happen to be on that subject. Number one, revise medical parole statute. Number two, revise statutory guidelines for available medical care for unsentenced and sentenced prisoners. Yet the Section 41 of Chapter 124 dealing with inmate medical care, subsection B, I'll read it. The legislature intends to measure the success of inmate health care section in achieving its mission by considering the number one, average medical cost per inmate, number two, amount of inmate copay fees collected annually. It seems to only measure the success financially. And it would seem to me that the most important thing is for preventative medical care and to keep people healthy and to rehabilitate people so when they get back out, they don't come back in, particularly if the only way they can get dialysis is to go to jail. And I'm wondering, do you folks think that we should look at a statutory amendment to that provision to put some qualitative goals as well as financial goals in there?
That's something we have to consider, I think, for...
I don't need an answer now, but I would appreciate a written answer through the chair.
Thank you. I also want to clarify part of your testimony. You had indicated on page 4 of your handout the department is anticipating an additional $1.2 million stemming from the recent vehicle accident on Seward Highway. That in no way constitutes an admission by the department of any liability. It simply is an estimate of damages claimed. Isn't that correct?
Right. That is correct.
Okay. And there's no...
those are actually relating to direct health care costs.
Mostly health care costs.
And the damaged van.
Correct.
Yeah.
I just want to make clear on the record that you're not conceding anything.
No, no. No, sir.
Any other further questions from the committee? Or Mr. Representative Samuels, anything? I want to thank you and your staff for coming up here this morning. You're the first one out of the chute, and we're glad to experiment on you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. I hope you do better next time.
Well, we're going to confirm you next time, maybe.
Sounds great. Well, let's hope we have a good week next week.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll
time,
stand in recess. Subject call.